This is NPR Illinois. I'm Jamie Dunn. This week, Illinois Issues takes a look back at the stories of the year for 2016. Much like last year, 2016 was marked by political inaction in Illinois. The state still doesn't have a real budget, and stopgap spending that was put into place over the summer seems poised to expire at the end of this month. After that temporary budget was approved in June, the political spotlight shifted to the general election. But the lack of a full state budget continues to cost the people of Illinois. A story I filed in September takes a look at some of those costs. During political events at the Illinois State Fair, Governor Bruce Rauner and House Speaker Michael Madigan rallied their troops, mostly against each other. Rauner didn't mention the Democratic House Speaker by name, but he called on his fellow Republicans to take on a political machine.
A corrupt political machine has taken over our home, and they are strangling our state. Well, you know what we're going to do, ladies and gentlemen? We are going to beat that machine and restore power to the people of Illinois. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
In his speech, Madigan gave members of his party two reasons to unite.
Number one, I think we can come together in opposition to the extremism of Donald Trump. Number two, I think we could all come together in opposition to the extremism of Bruce Rauner.
Both speeches offered plenty of red meat. What they didn't offer was proposals to get the state out of its current budget crisis. That lack of solutions has left Illinois citizens paying the price in some very real ways. Before kicking off campaign season, lawmakers approved and the governor signed into law spending meant to allow state government to limp along for another 6 months, until after the November election. The legislation has come to be known as the stopgap budget. Lawrence Massal, president of the fiscal watchdog group, the Civic Federation, bristles at that characterization.
It is not, in fact, a budget, because it's neither a comprehensive nor balanced approach to the state's expenditures and obligations. Stopgap implies that there is some end or stop to this financial recklessness.
Without a real plan in place, the business of state government is running on court orders, automatic spending, a K-12 education funding bill, and the so-called stopgap. That's left it spending billions more than it's taking in. How is Illinois coping? Mostly by just not paying its bills. Massal says putting off those payments comes at a price. Illinois racks up millions in interest charges.
All of its late bills, the state pays an unnecessary premium at the taxpayer's expense, money that could at best be used for critical areas and priority programs is being wasted at interest costs.
Martin Luby with the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs says the state could be paying less for its borrowing if it had its fiscal house in order.
Just like a person's credit, an individual's or a household's credit, as the credit rating goes down, the cost of borrowing goes up.
Luby took a look at a June bond sale to see how much the state could have saved. He says that the budget impasse's effect on the state's credit rating meant that Illinois spent about $12 million more on that sale. As it grapples with red ink, Illinois is not fully funding social services or higher education. It's also not investing in infrastructure. Luby says all of this will have long-term negative effects on the economy.
If we don't have investments in infrastructure throughout the state, I mean, these are some of the reasons why businesses will locate in a particular region or will decide to locate elsewhere.
Lack of funding for social services and higher education also has human costs. Lawrence Massal with the Civic Federation hopes that those costs will start to get people's attention.
For people who don't think the state budget affects them, I would challenge them to look around in their community and see the people that are on the streets looking for help. That's the impact of the state budget. Fellow citizens are not getting the services they need.
Reporting for Illinois Issues, I'm Jamie Dunn. One major policy change that did happen in 2017 was a revamping of the way K-12 schools can discipline students. Education Desk reporter Dusty Rhodes talked with several educators about how they were implementing the new law at different schools throughout the state.
The law is known simply as Senate Bill 100, but ask five different educators to explain what it requires, you're going to get five different explanations. Orlando Thomas, in charge of discipline for Champaign Schools, can fit his explanation on a Post-it note.
My understanding of Senate Bill 100 in a nutshell is the goal is to reduce exclusionary practices. And so the hope is that school districts are able to put in place interventions that would help to keep kids in school as opposed to sending them out.
Amy Biancari, who teaches at Batavia High School in Chicago's affluent western suburbs, has a slightly different perspective.
Senate Bill 100 basically makes it more difficult to suspend kids, especially for minor discipline infractions. So if a student was chronically truant and then insubordinate to teachers and, you know, they had certain like X amount of strikes and you're out, they don't do that anymore because it's counter to the success of the child.
So if marijuana was found in a student's locker, previously that student would have been suspended for 10 days. What will it be now?
Well, now they come back to school right away, and then we hired a drug and alcohol counselor who gets them help both inside and outside of school. We look at it as more of a health issue than a discipline issue.
Cody Rogers is the spokesperson for Noble, the largest charter school network in Chicago, known for strict discipline and getting kids into college.
There are new and more stringent administrative requirements surrounding discipline policies in public schools that all schools, traditional and charter, need to comply with. And so that's what we're doing and making sure that our policies are consistent with what SB 100 expects of us, while also still emphasizing school safety and culture as we always have. More paperwork, frankly.
Jennifer Gill is the superintendent of Springfield Schools.
It really calls upon you to apply two tests. When you think about a disciplinary infraction, did it significantly interrupt the process of learning at the school? And two, was it a threat to others? Was there a threat to do harm? Was there harm committed? So wearing yoga pants, something where you can, the first time you get a detention, the second time you get three detentions, the third time you might get in-house, so the fourth time you're suspended, that would no longer be a process that we can follow through with.
And finally, here's Chad Adams, principal of Chicago's Sullivan High School.
To me, that's an equity bill that will hopefully give kids a second chance when they need a chance to right their wrong and learn from their mistakes, and will hopefully drop the suspension rates and the suspension rates of minorities drastically.
His second chance policy, also known as restorative practices, is something Adams learned while he was assistant principal at Harper High in the Inglewood neighborhood, where 27 students were shot during a single year. Harper established a peace room, and Adams got trained to help kids resolve conflicts by talking. He's a certified circle keeper, and no, that does not mean he wears tie-dye. As for his equity comment, the law doesn't mention race or carve out any special treatment for minorities, but State Senator Kimberly Lightford, a Democrat from Maywood, says she pushed this bill because of racial disparities.
There was a 2012 study of the federal civil rights data found that Illinois suspends proportionally more African-American students than any other state in the entire United States and had the highest black-white suspension disparity in the country. That really solidified for me the urgency to continue working on this and getting something really solid on the books.
Reporting for the Education Desk and Illinois Issues, I'm Dusty Rhodes.
Several issues that captured the national spotlight also affected Illinois residents. Black Lives Matter is one of the largest activist movements since the civil rights era of the 1960s. The organization garnered more attention in the past year due to protests over the fatal police shootings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling. Meanwhile, attacks on police and the rise in prominence of white supremacy groups during the presidential election have shifted the conversation. In January, Rachel Otwell took a look at the origins of the Black Lives Matter movement and what it means for Illinois.
No racism, police! No justice, no peace! No justice, no peace!
You're hearing a video posted by the Champaign News Gazette. It's of a demonstration outside the county courthouse in December, one of several rallies the local chapter of Black Lives Matter has conducted to draw attention to systemic racism. Evelyn Reynolds is a professor at Parkland College and heads the chapter in Champaign.
Early on, we sat down and we said we need to have goals in mind of what exactly we want to do and what the best way of going about that is.
Black Lives Matter was founded by three women in the wake of Trayvon Martin's death. He was the teen shot by George Zimmerman in 2012. After another high-profile shooting, when a police officer killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, the movement gained more national attention. The slogan was quickly adopted by protesters. In Champaign, Reynolds says the focus has branched out from police brutality to local issues.
The racial disparities within the county jail, which are pretty significant, looking at schools and equity as far as Black students, because we see that they're expelled more, suspended more, dismissed from class more than other students.
Her chapter has about 150 people in its network. It targeted the Champaign County Board and called for the creation of a racial justice task force, which did ultimately happen. Reynolds says she has long been active in the community and has often done the polite thing. Met with officials, wrote letters and emails, but it hasn't always been effective. In Chicago, when a video was released showing Black teenager Laquan McDonald get shot 16 times by police, protesters made various attempts to draw attention. They pointed out the delay in releasing the video, which they view as a cover-up. Kathy Cheney reports for public radio station WBEZ and has covered dozens of Chicago rallies and marches. She says changes like the ouster of police superintendent Gary McCarthy, plans for increased use of body cameras by police, and reparations for some of those who police abused is due in part to the activism that's been happening since well before the video was released last November.
These young activists have been out here for more than a year, coming to every Chicago Police Board meeting. They've been coming to every city council meeting, every city council committee hearings. They've been out there in the streets marching, leading teach-ins.
It sounds similar to the civil rights activism of the 1950s and 60s. One way the movement is unique from the past, though, is its use of social media. DeRay McKesson recently appeared on The Late Show where he talked to Stephen Colbert about white privilege. He has 250,000 followers on Twitter and says the movement wouldn't be the same without it.
What we've been able to do using social media is like spread messages that otherwise would not have been spread and to tell the truth and communicate with each other in ways that previously had been impossible.
McKesson, based in Baltimore, has been an advocate for education, but it wasn't until the events in Ferguson that he shifted focus.
There was something about the killing of Mike Brown and the subsequent cover-up and the lack of information that radicalized so many of us, that mobilized so many of us to organize around ending police violence.
McKesson has traveled across the country for his work and has helped found a new effort called Campaign Zero. It provides data about police shootings and has put forth a 10-point solution, including demilitarization of police and better training. It's an example of one of many offshoots the movement has inspired. But groups long rooted in activism are also welcoming. Teresa Haley heads the state branch of the NAACP. She says she respects what Black Lives Matter is doing.
Their goal is not only to be heard, but to bring about changes in the criminal justice system. So I think as long as they stay focused, they will be around for some time to come.
Haley says overall the movement has been nonviolent and is largely comprised of young college-educated people from a variety of cultural and ethnic backgrounds. Most weren't around for the civil rights era of the 50s and 60s, but John Lewis was. Now a congressman, he chaired the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the 60s, counted Martin Luther King Jr. as a mentor, and nearly lost his life at the hands of police while peacefully demonstrating for voting rights in Alabama. He recently spoke to an audience at Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield. He gave the crowd this directive.
When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, you have a moral obligation, a mission, and a mandate to stand up. Speak up and speak out and make a little noise. Sometimes I think we're just too quiet.
Black Lives Matter activists show no intention to quiet down their efforts for change. I'm Rachel Otwell.
Perhaps the biggest story of the year in Illinois and across the country was the election of Donald Trump as president. In March, Brian Mackey considered what a Trump presidency might be like by looking to the state's own businessman turned politician, Governor Bruce Rauner.
As candidates, Bruce Rauner and Donald Trump shared core elements of their messages to voters. Each makes the case that they amassed their vast wealth because of their competence in the world of business, and that, they argue, would make them well-suited to the world of politics. Here's Rauner in a primary debate from 2014.
I'm not a politician. I'm a self-made business guy. But I know how to drive results. I know how to work. I know how to fight. I know how to win.
And Trump, speaking after his Super Tuesday victories.
We have great, great power. The problem is we have politicians that truly, truly, truly don't know what they're doing.
Now, at this point, I should pause to acknowledge that comparing anyone to Trump could be seen as slanderous in some circles. So it's worth mentioning that there's no evidence Rauner shares Trump's most notorious opinions on Mexican immigrants, women, and violence. In fact, Rauner campaigned in the opposite direction, courting African-American voters, reassuring women he, quote, didn't have a social agenda, and disavowing a supporter's Confederate flag patch. And yet, other similarities between Trump and Rauner are self-evident, particularly with regard to people who became politicians before they did.
They're all controlled by these people. And the people that control them are the special interests, the lobbyists, and the donors.
And I won't sit back and wait and watch while the career politicians and the special interest groups in Springfield take us down a long road of decline.
The thing is, while that message resonates with voters, it can be a harder sell when you need those career politicians and so-called special interests to pass your legislative agenda. During Rauner's campaign, a number of pundits believe the negotiating savvy he honed, making hundreds of millions of dollars, would serve him well as governor. And shortly after taking office, Rauner bragged to a writer for the Wall Street Journal that he'd built up very good working relationships with Democratic leaders. There's mutual respect, Rauner said. There's mutual trust that has not existed from prior governors. Today, however, it taxes the imagination to conceive of a scenario in which there could be less mutual trust among Rauner, House Speaker Michael Madigan, and Senate President John Cullerton. That's in part because the Republican governor frequently attacks the Democrats who lead Illinois' legislative branch of government.
Mike Madigan is making millions, millions from his law firm from high property taxes. John Cullerton making huge wealth from his law firm from government inside deals.
In a 2004 interview, Rauner told the magazine Private Equity International that he's become friendly with his business partners over cigars and hunting trips. He said, "Life's too short to work with folks that you're not going to enjoy." Apparently. It's been 3 months since the governor last called a meeting with all four legislative leaders. Look, this is not to say Democrats don't share the blame for the state government shutdown. They had years in which they controlled both the governor's mansion and the legislature, and yet they failed to permanently balance the budget. And it's that kind of dysfunction that makes the run-it-like-a-business candidate seem so appealing to voters. Ultimately, however, the promise and the peril of the CEO politician is the same thing. That they'll bring their business mindset to bear on a realm that doesn't always abide the rules of business. One can only hope the governor soon works out how best to apply his past skill set to his new line of work. And as for Trump, his success or failure could hinge on which version of the CEO politician he chooses to be, the dealmaker or the demagogue. I'm Brian Mackey.
You can read all of those Illinois Issues Stories of the Year, plus a few you didn't hear about here, at our website, nprillinois.org.